Right, ma'am? Perkins looked up from her tablet and nodded. That's right, Lieutenant Bonsu. You do what the man says. Yes, Major, Bonsu said shakily. Is this a Special Forces unit, ma'am? He asked that skeptically. None of the five had Special Forces unit insignia on their uniforms. Hell yes, Jesse answered seriously. We're the most Special Force you've ever seen. Not exactly, Perkins said. Excuse me, ma'am, Shauna interjected. I think Jesse is right. Has there ever been a mission more special than this? We destroyed a battle group. Perkins paused. You may be right about that. Lieutenant Bonsu, we're going to drop your pilot off someplace that has a Ruhar medical facility. To the relief of Perkins, there had not been any discussion of ignoring the Ruhar pilot after they picked up Bonsu. Then our secret will be out anyway, so you might as well hear it now. We, Irene called from the cockpit. Major Perkins, could you come up here, please? Perkins stood, holding onto a strap, as Irene was flying the Buzzard close to the ground and the flight was not smooth. Jarrett, Coulter, tell Lieutenant Bonsu what we've been doing. We will, Shauna acknowledged. Lieutenant, let's start with three words, okay? Giant, Mazer, Cannons. They selected a medium-sized village that had a fully equipped hospital, no Ruhar military presence, and was comfortably within the Buzzard's range of its depleted power cells. Irene warned that they needed to go back to the truck and refuel after dropping the Ruhar pilot off. The Buzzard would be flying on reserves just to get back to the truck. Perkins considered waiting until darkness, but Bonsu insisted that Saley was in a coma already, and she could not wait any longer unless they wanted responsibility for a dead Ruhar pilot. So Perkins ordered Irene to land the Buzzard on the hospital's landing pad. Irene began extending the rear ramp as the landing gear came down. As soon as the Buzzard settled its weight on the landing pad, Dave and Jesse carried Saley out. Shauna escorted them, a Ruhar rifle in her arms, the muzzle pointed at the ground but a finger alongside the trigger in case of trouble. A door opened, and three confused Ruhar stepped out of the hospital. There had not been a call from an incoming aircraft, and now there were three humans in front of them. One of the humans had a rifle. A Ruhar rifle. Humans were not supposed to have weapons at all. Jesse and Dave laid Saley down carefully, then backed away with their hands up. The three Ruhar were not looking at Jesse and Dave. They were looking at the rifle in Shauna's hands. Dave pointed at Saley. Help her, he shouted in Ruhar over the whine of the Buzzard's engines. Help her. One of the Ruhar nodded, so the three humans backed away, Shauna last. At the very top of the ramp, she hit the button to retract the ramp and shouted for Irene to go. Irene lifted off very gently, wary of her jet exhaust kicking up debris and injuring the Ruhar. When she reached 100 meters altitude, she engaged the stealth field and pointed the Buzzard's nose straight toward the truck. "We don't have the fuel to fly a maximum stealth course," she explained to Derek in the co-pilot seat. While the man was still too weak to take the controls, he could monitor instruments for her. Derek had trained on Buzzards before switching to chicken gunships. "You're sure the truck is still there?" Derek asked. "It had better be, or we'll be walking." The Buzzard made it back to the truck and they refueled, although they were only able to supply half of the fuel the Buzzard could hold. "We're not going to be flying far, ma'am," Irene told Perkins. "I hope MB doesn't expect us to bring more than one projector online. We're done doing this all by ourselves. The Kristang have dozens of teams searching for projectors," Perkins frowned. They knew about the Kristang from listening to chatter on the Ruhar civilian network. Although the Kristang still didn't know exactly where additional projectors might be located, they could guess, based on where they would have installed projectors. "It's time for the Ruhar to take over this task. I'm messaging MB now." Prepared for an argument, Perkins was pleasantly surprised when MB immediately agreed that it was time for the Ruhar planetary government to be officially brought into the effort to activate and control projectors. MB was going to send a message to Ruhar government officials, but Perkins had a better idea. "I'm going to call someone I know," she typed. "After I talk with her, you can send her a message." MB agreed. Paterna Logelia's phone beeped with a priority call, and she answered it automatically, assuming it was one of her staff calling. "Hello, Burgermeister." It was a human voice, speaking acceptable Ruhar with a heavy accent. "This is Major Emily Perkins." Paterna held the phone away from her ear and stared at it. How had Perkins made her phone beep with a priority message?
"Hello, Major Perkins. How are you?"
"Where are you?" Paterna wanted to ask. Perkins and three other humans escaped from a train and the Ruhar had not been able to find any trace of them.
"I am well."
Perkins spoke precisely, as many human expressions did not translate into the alien language.
"We have been busy. We escaped from a train, then we stole a truck, and we stole an aircraft. Also, we rescued two pilots who had been shot down. Oh, and before that, we were flying around activating giant maser cannons."
Paterna gasped, loudly enough that Perkins could hear.
"Would you be interested," Perkins asked, "in learning where all the other projectors are located? It has gotten to the point where my team needs help. We can show you how to access and activate a projector, and our friend can give you a map of all the projectors on the planet."
"Your friend?"
Paterna asked cautiously, while frantically waving to get the attention of her staff.
"We call our friend Emby. Check your phone for a message. It should be there now."
Chapter 22 Commodore Ferlant's plan to regain the initiative relied on his people to be the competent, disciplined professionals that he knew they were, and it relied on the Cristang being Cristang. The destroyer City of Falentin departed the task force, performed a series of jumps, and finally jumped in less than 3 light minutes from where the 5 ships of the Cristang Pursuit Force were holding station. Senior Captain Gurkhaw knew what he should have done. He should have held position with 4 of his ships and dispatched a frigate to Admiral Kikrondo, informing the battlegroup commander of the development and requesting instructions, but that would not have been any fun. Besides, the Admiral's position was precarious, and if Gurkhaw could show successful aggressiveness, the clan leaders could only look favorably on him as an alternative if the weak and indecisive Kikrondo suffered more losses. Instead of doing what he should have done, what he knew the Admiral wanted him to do, Gurkhaw took the excuse of falling back on Kikrondo's standing order to pursue. The Ruhar ships were no longer beyond the distant boundaries of the star system. Therefore, as far as Gurkhaw was concerned, the previous order to pursue them was reinstated. His crews, who sought glory and promotion as much as Gurkhaw did, followed their senior captain's lead with great enthusiasm. Aboard his own light cruiser, a fearless warrior's honor is his greatest weapon, Gurkhaw jumped in to surround the Lenten with 3 ships. Holding 2 ships in reserve. As soon as his 3 ships emerged from their jump wormholes, they extended damping fields at maximum power, holding back stealth capability and defensive shields in order to link up the damping fields into an impenetrable barrier around the Ruhar ship. Gurkhaw was relying on speed, shock, and surprise. He paid for it, or rather his people paid for his aggressiveness. The Lenten was ready to be surrounded, expecting a damping field to be extended around it. Rather than activating its own defensive shield, the Lenten channeled all of its power into 2 maser cannons, pouring bolt after bolt of searing maser energy at a single ship. The Cristang destroyer, we are proud to follow the shining example of warrior pilot Ostenval Pentot. The unshielded Pentot staggered, sustaining direct hits to its reactor armor. To protect its ship from a catastrophic reactor breach, the reactor automatically took itself offline and ejected its plasma in a controlled manner, which left the powerful destroyer running on only backup energy supplies. With more maser bolts coming in from the fully shielded Lenten, the Pentot's captain ordered his ship to perform an emergency micro-jump. Knowing that he might later be accused of cowardice by the senior captain, the Pentot's captain judged that being alive to defend himself was a better option than the prospect of posthumously having a ship named after himself. Unfortunately, the damage to the Pentot's reactor and the superheated plasma spewing from the reactor's ejection system had caused a fluctuation in power flow to the jump drive capacitors. The capacitor control system was desperately attempting to compensate when a signal from the bridge forced a jump that the drive system was not ready for. The jump of 10 light seconds was only partly successful, with the coils rupturing while the ship was still inside the wormhole. The unlucky Pentot cleared the event horizon of the jump wormhole's far end, and immediately emergency protocols kicked in automatically. Explosive bolts blew in rapid sequence, bulkheads tore apart, cables were ripped from their connections, and the aft engineering section of the destroyer was deliberately separated in a last-ditch attempt to save the ship.
The attempt was successful in that when the remaining stored power in the jump drive capacitors was released in a massive explosion, the drive unit was no longer attached to the ship. Because of that precaution, only half of the Pentot's crew died when the shockwave of the explosion hit the hull. As an additional insult, the destroyer Lenten jumped away just before the damping field could surround her. Senior Captain Gurkaw howled in anger and frustration.
"Idiot!"
he shouted at the captain of the crippled Pentot, raging at the man's lack of ship maintenance that had left the Pentot so vulnerable. Even though it was Senior Captain Gurkaw who had ignored his commander's increasingly strident pleas for time to repair their worn-down ships, and even though it had been Gurkaw's insistence that his three ships leave defensive shields offline in order to put all available power into the damping field, that had been a gamble by Gurkaw that the Pentot's crew had lost, and Gurkaw was aware that his own ship, the light cruiser Fearless, could easily have been the target of the Ruhar ship's maser fire. If the Ruhar had targeted the Fearless instead, Gurkaw could very well be dead right then, and that fear fed his rage. With no hesitation, he recalled his two reserve ships and ordered immediate pursuit. Because the Ruhar ship had not dropped off a quantum resonator to mask where it had jumped to, Gurkaw's force was able to pursue with a short jump within 6 minutes of the Lenten's escape. When the pursuit force arrived at the coordinates of the Ruhar ship's jump, they found not the Lenten, but the still hotly vibrating remnants of an outbound wormhole. The enemy must be desperate, Gurkaw concluded with glee, for the Ruhar ship had again failed to use a quantum resonator, and based on the noisiness of the collapsed jump wormhole, the enemy ship's drive was in poor condition. The enemy task force must be out of resonators and unable to repair their jump drives. Having disobeyed the spirit, if not the letter, of the Admiral's orders, and having subsequently lost a warship, Senior Captain Gurkaw knew that he absolutely had to kill the enemy ship if he had any chance to avoid being thrown in the brig, or even executed for insubordination and incompetence. The Kristang warrior culture could forgive unsanctioned boldness. It could not tolerate failure. He ordered a coordinated jump with all four of his remaining ships, as soon as the enemy ship's jump position could be calculated. This time, Gurkaw told himself while smashing his fist down on a console, he had the enemy. With its jump drive in poor condition, the enemy could not possibly jump away soon enough. At last, victory and revenge would be his. Demonstrating admirable coordination and more than a little bit of luck, Gurkaw's ships all arrived at the designated jump point within a second of each other. The fact that one ship had emerged on the wrong side of the target and that two ships had almost collided because their jumps were so inaccurate bothered Gurkaw not at all. Poor jump accuracy was such a common malady in Kristang jump drives that crews joked their lack of accuracy was a feature, not a flaw. The nagging fact that his ship's jump navigation computers could barely hit the side of a barn from inside the barn did not bother Gurkaw. With four ships, he had been able to surround the enemy. The Ruhar destroyer was right where he had expected it to be, and he...
No!
Gurkaw shouted with shock as his ship was rocked by multiple explosions. The shields of the Fearless flicked from the strain, and he heard the rattling of the point defense guns warding off more incoming missiles. Then he was thrown across the bridge as the light cruiser spun to one side from taking a railgun dart through her bow. It was an ambush. The enemy must have salted the area with free-floating missiles using the destroyer as a decoy. To his horror, on the main bridge display, he watched that enemy destroyer flying at maximum acceleration directly toward the destroyer Vikran. The two destroyers exchanged heavy fire, with both ships staggering from the close-range impacts. Then the symbols on the display merged as the Ruhar ship deliberately collided with the Vikran. With a combined speed of over 15,000 kilometers per hour, the hulls of both ships were effectively vaporized even before their reactors and drive capacitors exploded.
"Take us!"
Gurkaw never finished the order, as a second railgun dart from the cruiser Rue Gastalo had targeted a Fearless warrior's honor as his greatest weapon. On its way to the Kristang ship at 18% of the speed of light, the railgun dart did not have time to ponder whether the crew of the ship was indeed Fearless, or whether honor was a better weapon than a railgun dart. At the moment, that seemed unlikely. The dart scored a direct hit on the reactor, and the light cruiser blossomed into a blinding ball of light. "Two down, Commodore," the Lenten's former captain reported in a strained voice. She had just watched her crewless former ship ram an enemy, and now she was a captain without a ship at all. Commodore Ferlant had taken the doomed Lenten's crew aboard his cruiser. With two captains suddenly aboard one ship, Ferlant took the opportunity to have Lenten's former captain handle the tactical console, allowing Executive Officer Smith to concentrate on maneuvering the Rugistallo in combat. The damping field extended by Ferlant's ships had effectively trapped the two surviving ships of the Cristang Pursuit Force, a matching pair of frigates.
"Signal to all ships. Concentrate fire on that closest frigate," Ferlant ordered.
Of the two small warships, one of them had jumped in considerably off course and had been turning to close the distance to the original target. Now that the target Lenten was no more, and the Ruhar had turned the tables on the Cristang, that wayward frigate was headed at maximum acceleration toward the edge of the damping field. The other frigate, which had with considerable pride jumped in much closer to the Lenten's calculated position, now began to regret its pride, for it found itself the sole target of five Ruhar warships. And shortly thereafter, it found itself briefly creating a new sun in the sky, as it was wiped from existence.
"Shall we shift fire to the other frigate, Commodore? We could..."
"Oh," Smith said with a start.
"It's our old friend the Glory. Sir, we could swat that tiny insect now and be done with it."
"No, let it be," Ferlant said with a smile. "Drop the damping field."
"Because fate, for some unknown reason, has a fondness for that particular ship, Commodore?" Smith asked quietly.
"No," Ferlant declared. "This time, fate has already favored our little friend out there. I want a ship to carry the good news back to Admiral Kikrondo. When he hears about the little disaster that his pursuit force stupidly jumped into, his overly developed Cristang sense of bravado will demand that he come after us with the remainder of his ships. His bravado and his sense of self-preservation. Kikrondo will know the only way for him to avoid absolute disgrace will be to hunt us down and kill every single one of our ships."
"That is something for which you have a plan to avoid," Smith raised an eyebrow. "Sir?"
"Yes, I do, Mr. Smith. Don't worry about that," Ferlant said with a well-satisfied chuckle. "I plan for us to lead Admiral Kikrondo on a merry chase for as long as necessary. While he is vainly pursuing us, he won't be able to interfere in the events on Getanu, and that will get the government there off our backs. I find them considerably more vexing than my counterpart in the Cristang battle group."
After Commodore Ferlant destroyed their pursuit force, the Cristang tried to chase his ships around the system, but both sides knew the situation had become a stalemate. On the ground, Major Perkins and her team had managed to activate a total of 7 projectors before we turned the process over to the Ruha Planetary Government. The Cristang had also been busy activating projectors and attempting to capture or destroy projectors controlled by the Ruha. It had become a bloody ground war, with both sides having few aircraft left to throw into the fight. 5 days after Ferlant destroyed the pursuit force, the Ruha government offered a new ceasefire to Admiral Kikrondo. It took him a day, and probably a lot of alcohol or whatever lizards drink, to swallow the bitter terms and accept the offer. The new ceasefire terms prevented either side from having ships in orbit, but with both sides now controlling deadly projectors, neither commander wanted to risk his ships anywhere near the planet. Both sides ceased activity to activate additional projectors. There was, of course, some cheating on both sides, but it was surprisingly minor. The Ruha had an advantage in active projectors. The Cristang had plenty of projectors under their control, which Skippy was unable to mess with because the Cristang were using manual controls. The real reason that the Cristang had agreed to another ceasefire was the same reason they had offered the first ceasefire. After all the fighting and deaths on both sides, the Ruha federal government still intended to trade the planet for something better. The negotiations were now no longer a secret. All the native Ruha knew, and they all protested, and they all accomplished nothing. Everything we had done, activating secret long-dormant projectors and blasting a Cristang battle group out of the sky, had been to bring the situation back to where it was before Admiral Kikrondo's battle group had arrived to take control of the space around Paradise. Which meant we still had the same problem. The Ruha did not want to keep a relatively isolated agricultural planet. All we had done was drive up the price they could ask the Cristang in return. So far, we hadn't done anything to actually help UNEF.
Flying Dutchman.
Welcome back, Colonel Bishop. Major Smythe greeted me with a crisp salute as I stepped out of the dropship.
It's good to be back, Major, I replied. It was good to be back aboard our pirate ship. It felt like home.
Have you been busy? I asked that as a joke, knowing Smythe would have kept his Spec Ops people training full time.
Oh, no, sir, he said with a straight face. With you on Paradise doing all the work, we've been on vacation, sleeping late and having afternoon tea with crumpets.
Sounds good. What's a crumpet?
I think you Americans would say that it is like a thick sort of pancake, only it's round.
All pancakes are round, I said, confused. Except when my father made them when we went camping and he forgot to bring a spatula to flip them. In that case, he pushed the half-cooked mess around with a spoon to make scrambled pancakes. They were not super yummy.
These are perfectly round, sir. He made a circle with his hands. The batter is poured into a ring on the griddle, so it stays round.
Oh, I brightened. Like an Egg McMuffin.
I wouldn't know, sir, he replied, unintentionally making me feel like an idiot.
Successful mission, sir. The ceasefire is back in effect, but now the Ruhar have complete control of the planet.
Partially successful, Major. The Ruhar government still intends to trade the planet to the highest bidder. All we have accomplished so far is to drive up the price the Ruhar can get. They won't even need to throw in floor mats or rust-proofing. And we have no plan for how to prevent the Ruhar from selling the planet out from under UNEF's feet.
I'm sure we'll think of something, sir, he said, looking at me in a way that made it clear he expected me to come up with an idea.
We always do.
Right now, Major, what I have is a whole lot of nothing.
On the way to report to Chotek, I stopped by the science lab to check on what our group of geniuses had been doing while I had been stirring up trouble on Paradise. Dr. Sarah Rose and two others were working on some complicated piece of machinery, whose purpose I couldn't even guess at. A resident rocket scientist, Dr. Friedlander, was sitting at a desk doing something on a laptop.
Are you working on a design for a better jump drive? I asked.
He turned his laptop around so I could see the screen.
No, I'm doing Sudoku while I give my brain a rest. It used to be that we'd get a break while a supercomputer took hours to run a simulation for us. But here Skippy has the simulations done before we hit the enter key. Then Skippy tells us what we did wrong with programming the simulation parameters, but he won't fix it for us.
You monkeys won't learn anything if I do the work for you, Skippy said through Friedlander's laptop speakers.
Yes, Friedlander said. He keeps telling us that. He will tell us we got something wrong, but he won't tell us what is wrong or how to fix it.
He flipped a finger at the laptop's camera. It wasn't his index finger.
I saw that, Skippy laughed.
Dr. Friedlander, just think of how proud you will be of your accomplishments when you figure out how something works on your own. And hey, you almost are able to understand how Theranin doorknobs work.
Skippy, I retorted. I wasn't funny. These people, he wasn't joking, Friedlander said as he shook his head sadly. The manual door latch mechanism uses a magnetic catch, but it appears to be pure energy. There's no physical magnet that we can see, so we don't know what generates the magnetic field.
Are you making any progress? I asked hopefully. If the science team could bring back useful insights into Theranin or even Kristang technology, UNEF Command would consider this mission a great success. But our team of geniuses didn't know how a doorknob functioned?
That was not encouraging.
Not yet, Friedlander admitted.
That was a nice way of saying no. We have not made any measurable progress. This trip has not been entirely useless so far. We have been able to invalidate some ideas we developed during the last mission, and from what we have observed during jumps, we are certain that our current theories of quantum mechanics are wrong. Technically, instead of adding to humanity's base of knowledge, we are subtracting from it.
There, see? Skippy said cheerily. Look at how clever you monkeys are.
That is not helping, Skippy, I said, knowing that helping wasn't part of Skippy's plan.
Seriously, you can't give us a hint about a freaking doorknob?
Nope. Well, here's a hint. If you can figure out the doorknob, you'll be a step closer to understanding our reactor containment system. And I shouldn't be saying this. Our defensive energy shields.
Reactors? I asked. How about the reactors?
No, Friedlander said dejectedly. Same with the jump drive, the stealth field, artificial gravity, you name it. Colonel, everything on this ship is beyond our understanding.
So far, I said as encouragement.
So far.
Chotek let out a long breath and ran a hand through his hair, in a combination of frustration and fatigue.
We all felt like he did.
Colonel Bishop, this operation has been entirely successful so far. Congratulations to you and your team. Before I could respond, he added, Now we are back to the original problem. The Ruha still intend to give up this planet through a negotiated settlement. All we appear to have accomplished is strengthening the negotiating position of the Ruha. The Kristang will have to offer more valuable territory in exchange for paradise. I could cling to the hope that the Kristang are not able to deliver a price the Ruha will find acceptable. However, we know the Ruha do not want this planet at all. The Ruha desire to get rid of paradise. The only question is, what kind of bargain they get for it?
What an asshole, I thought. He could have paused one freaking minute after praising the merry band of pirates, giving me time to pass on the mission commander's congratulations to the whole crew. Or better yet, he could have done it himself. Instead, he soured a nice moment by moving directly on to the next problem. Some people have absolutely no sense of timing.
Sir, I said, trying to keep the irritation from my voice and losing that struggle. Before, we did not have any opportunity to affect the outcome here. The Kristang had control of the planet, and the Ruha weren't willing to commit the resources necessary to dislodge them. Now we could potentially give the Ruha a reason to retain paradise under their control.
How? Chotek asked simply. How can we do that without exposing our involvement?
We also need to return to the relay station in order to complete our primary mission, he reminded me needlessly.
As of this moment, we do not have a working plan to ensure the Ruha keep control of paradise. With the operation on Paradise completed, we can move on to plan in the next phase. Until now, we haven't had the time to think about it.
Do you have any ideas? Any at all?
Sir, I would rather not discuss potential options until I have had time to review them with my team for feasibility, I said truthfully. What I did not say was that I had zero ideas right then. I also did not mention my pride in knowing the word feasibility that had been on an officer training PowerPoint slide. I'd had to look up the definition because I had no clue what feasibility meant at the time.
If something could be feasible, did that mean fees was a verb? How would you fees?
I would look that up later. We do not have to depart for the relay station immediately. I request 5 days here to develop plans.
3 days, Colonel, Chotek replied. Every day we are away from the relay station jeopardizes our primary mission. I am concerned the situation there may have changed during our absence. With the fluid military situation in this sector between the Theranin and Jarratha, the crew rotation schedule may have changed, or a damaged warship may have stopped at the station to facilitate repairs. For all we know, the Jarratha might have forced the Theranin away from the area and captured that station. While we remain here considering options to secure the safety of humans on Paradise, we risk the safety of humans on Earth.
He was right, and I couldn't argue with him about it.
3 days. Yes, sir.
To get my brain going, I went to the gym for a hard workout, then took a quick shower and went to my office. While I was in the gym, I had been kicking ideas around in my head and listening to ideas from the Spec Ops commanders, including Major Smythe.
Skippy, I said as I slumped in my chair. My legs were rubbery from exercise.
We have some ideas I want to discuss with you.
Of course you do, he sighed. Another shining opportunity for monkeys to be smarter than me. Go ahead, make me look like an idiot again. I've been working on the problem of getting the Ruha to retain paradise, and so far I got nothing. Nothing. With all my ginormous brain power, I can't think of a solution. What's going to happen is your stupid meat-based monkey brain is going to say, duh, what about this, and solve the whole freaking problem. Damn, I hate you. I hate my life.
Skippy, we don't dream up ideas to make you feel like an idiot.
Thank you, Joe. That's just a delicious bonus, thus reminding me why I so very much hate you, Joe.
Hey, I'd love for you to solve all our problems for us, I admitted. That way UNEF Command could bust your balls about every freaking decision you make instead of mine. Since you can't think up solutions to every problem, we humans have to step up.
Your species is maddeningly clever, especially you, Joe. I speculate that when you don't have big teeth or claws and can't fly, the only way your species avoided being eaten by leopards is by becoming clever. Anyway, he sighed again. Go ahead, tell me your brilliant, clever, innovative, monkey-brained idea, and let's get my humiliation over with, shall we?
Skippy, I wanted to discuss ideas with him, but needed to satisfy my curiosity first.
Why is it every time we think up an idea you couldn't, you act like it's the first time it's ever happened? You must be used to it by now.
That is not entirely my fault, Joe. In my matrix is a processor that keeps track of time and events. As you may have noticed, my occasional absent-mindedness...
Occasional?
Occasional?
He ignored me.
This processor is perhaps not functioning optimally. The truth is, this processor simply cannot believe any of you lesser beings could be smarter than me about anything. It can't happen, therefore my processor assumes that the data input is garbled or that I am hallucinating. In order to acknowledge you having any kind of a good idea, I have to manually override this processor. So, emotionally, it is new to me each time.
Wow. I'm sorry that...
Also, on my timescale, so much time passes between you having a good idea that it is an exceedingly rare occurrence. Like, every couple hundred million years, an asteroid crashes into Earth. But that kind of thing is not in a typical 5-day forecast, you know?
The one constant is that you are an asshole.
Yes! See, Joe, he said happily, there is order in the universe. So, getting back to the subject, what moronic ideas do you wish to waste my time with?
Moronic. Did you already forget the conversation we just had about how clever monkeys are?
Sometimes. How clever monkeys sometimes are.
Rarely.
Go ahead. Hit me with your best shot, Joey, my boy.
All right. The Ruhar used to want this planet before the wormhole shift made access to paradise impractical for them. Now the wormhole that connects to Ruhar territory is far away, while the wormhole that connects to Kristang territory is closer. Our question is this. Can you use your magic beanstalk, I meant the Elder Wormhole controller module in one of our cargo bays, to reset the wormhole connections back to the way they used to be? Or maybe just cut off the Kristang wormhole so they no longer want paradise?
Okay. Okay, that is not an astronomically stupid question, he said with an undertone of surprise.
I assume you led off with your best idea and they will only grow progressively moronic from here.
That was not a totally stupid question, but the answer is no. No on many, many levels, Joe. First, if I shut down another wormhole, someone is going to quickly grow very suspicious that wormholes mysteriously shut down near the only two planets in the galaxy that are occupied by humans.
Crap. Okay. I had considered that problem.
Then there is the larger issue that the more I screw with wormhole connections, the greater risk there is that we could trigger an unpredictable cascade of wormhole shifts. That wormhole controller module allows me to adjust one wormhole at a time. I can't use it to change the parameters of the underlying wormhole network. Joe, I can very temporarily change the connection of one wormhole as long as it goes right back to its baseline program shortly. A permanent change risks the network deciding to institute a major shift that might be very bad for humanity. A major shift could bring that wormhole near Earth back to life.
You never mentioned that, I protested.
Crap!
That is an unlikely possibility, Joe, as long as we do not screw further with the network.
There is worse news. That wormhole we shut down is not actually the closest one to Earth. There is another dormant wormhole much closer to Earth. That closer wormhole has not been active for millions of years. If we screw with wormholes, the network might decide to wake that closer wormhole from its dormancy. So, while I could play with the paradise wormholes to persuade the Ruhar to keep this planet, that would be an extremely risky idea.
Damn. That was the easiest idea we had.
Easiest. You think adjusting an elder wormhole is easy?
Easy for us, Skippy. You do all the work.
Fair enough, I guess. What other ideas do you have?
My second idea probably won't work either. We thought that whatever planet the Kristang are offering to trade for paradise, we could cut off wormhole access to it. Then the Ruhar wouldn't want to make the trade, but... Now I see that won't work.
Nope, it won't work. Same problem of potentially triggering a cascading wormhole shift. That idea is even worse, Joe. If we cut off access to one planet the Kristang are offering to trade, they could then offer another planet, and we'd have to cut off access to that one also.
Man, the Maxalks and Rindaloo would get super suspicious right away about a series of wormholes shutting down.
One wormhole shutting down is an isolated anomaly. A series of wormholes going dead is a pattern. The Rindaloo and Maxalks are smart, and they have reasonably smart AIs. A pattern will attract their interest. You do not want to get those senior species involved in any way, Joe.
Yeah, I figured that.
Crap.
Then our third idea is... No, that won't work either, damn it. How can we get the Kristang to not take over Paradise when the Ruha are eager to hand it to them?
Stupid hamsters, Skippy grumbled. The only truly valuable thing on the whole planet was me, and the Ruha stuck me on a dusty shelf. Serves them right for...
Just like that, bam, an idea came into my head.
Oh, wow. I just had an idea.
Skippy chuckled. Worse than your other ideas that we just discarded?
Better. We've been thinking of ways to make the Ruha decide that giving up Paradise isn't worth the deal, even though they really don't want the planet anymore. What if instead we found a way to make them want to keep Paradise, make them really, really want to keep it?
How? The whole planet is a farm, Joe. What are we going to do, grow an extra super prize-winning pumpkin or something?
He laughed. Gitanu is a farm now. I used the Ruha name for the planet. When the Kristang originally came here, they hoped to find valuable artifacts from a crashed Elder starship. Duh, I know that. I was on that ship. I think. The lizards did not find a functioning Elder power tap, and then they only found a few other less valuable trinkets. Now that I have left, there is nothing else of value on, around, or under the planet. That's why the Kristang Black Tree Clan was willing to give it up without a fight way back when the Ruhar originally came here.
Did you not pay attention when I was telling you all this important information?
I did pay attention, Skippy. I'm trying to think of a good way to explain my idea to you.
Oh, well, take your time, Joe. After all, the clock isn't ticking for the survival of UNEF. We have plenty of time.
Damn it. Fine. I hated when an untrustworthy beer can decided to remind me of duty. The Kristang are eager to get the planet back because they think valuable elder goodies are still buried there. What if the Ruha thought the same thing?
Great idea, Joe, except for one problem. The Ruha are on Paradise now. Any hint of Elder stuff that we gave to them could be quickly checked out and disproved.
Excellent point, Skippy, but you don't understand my idea. What if the Ruha did find valuable Elder stuff on Paradise, even one item? Then you could plant data suggesting there is a lot more. The Ruha would believe it then.
Wow. And you call me sneaky.
Don, that is a good idea. You're correct. If the Ruha found any valuable Elder artifacts, they would certainly want to retain control of Paradise.
There is only one problem with your idea, Joe. The fact that there are no valuable Elder artifacts on Paradise, you dumbass.
There aren't any there now, Skippy.
Skippy took one of his signature pauses. If you are proposing some sort of time travel, Joe, then I hate to tell you.
No time travel involved. I'm suggesting we go find some valuable Elder thing, hide it on Paradise, and arrange for the Ruha to find it.
Just like that?
Just like that. Come on, we found a bunch of previously unknown Elder sites on our last mission.
Ugh, Skippy groaned. May I point out that we also found a lot of useless and damaged Elder sites, and that we also ran into an ambush that very nearly destroyed the ship?
Details, I said with a dismissive wave of my hand. Assuming we could find a valuable enough Elder artifact, would that persuade the Ruha to keep Paradise?
Assuming? That is one hell of an assumption.
Yes. The answer is yes. Every species desires Elder technology more than anything and will fight to get it and keep it.
This would need to be a very valuable Elder artifact, Joe. Something that is worth the Ruha permanently stationing a battle group at Paradise.
Understood. One problem at a time, Skippy. Let's tackle one problem at a time.
Okay. We have a plan for incentivizing the Ruha to keep Paradise. We can figure out where to find Elder stuff later after we go back to the relay station. This buys us a lot of time.
Tackling only one problem at a time is how you paint yourself into a corner, Joe.
Desperate times call for desperate measures, Skippy.
Do they call for stupid measures?
Oh, shut up. You're just mad because a monkey thought up a plan before you. If you call hoping for Santa Claus to deliver an Elder artifact a plan, then sure.
No, I'm hoping for a miracle from Skippy Claus.
Since your idea is to hide goodies on Paradise for the Ruha to find, perhaps you should be wishing for the Easter Bunny, Joe. This would be the best Easter egg of all time. After I explained my idea of planting an Easter egg on Paradise, the plan was enthusiastically approved by Chotek, Chang, Sims, and Smythe. Except for the nagging detail that, you know, we didn't have a valuable Elder artifact to hide on Paradise, or any idea where to find one, or any idea how to search for one. Despite having one plan, we still remained in the vicinity of Paradise for the full 3 days, in case we thought up a better plan that could be implemented sooner. No one thought up a better plan,
so we set course for a Neptune-sized cold gas planet at the outskirts of the Paradise system and headed there at 75% acceleration. As soon as we swung behind the far side of that planet, and Skippy assured us there were no other ships around, we jumped, using the great bulk of the planet to conceal our gamma ray burst from prying eyes on Paradise. Chapter 23. As we headed back toward the relay station that we had captured, I was on the bridge, still not having any idea how to find a super valuable Elder artifact. To cheer myself up, I tried to cheer up Skippy. "Hey, Skippy, while we're on this Easter egg hunt, maybe we'll find a comm note for you," I suggested. "Hmm. Yeah, great. Wonderful, Joe." That didn't sound right, and I wasn't the only one who picked up on Skippy's lack of enthusiasm. I nodded to Adams through the glass that separated the bridge from the CIC, and she came around the corner. Wordlessly, I rose from the command chair so Adams could take command. She gave me a silent thumbs up as I brushed past her and out the doorway. Although Skippy would argue that it was a useless gesture because we could communicate perfectly well anywhere aboard the ship, I walked down the corridor to Skippy's personal escape pod. The hatch to the ship was open. That violated protocol for escape pods, but this one was special. There my favorite shiny beer can rested on a cushioned seat. A magnetic clamp hidden under the cushion held Skippy firmly in place. I tried to stop by the escape pod to speak with our friendly omnipotent alien AI at least once a day. Skippy said I was wasting my time, but I think he appreciated me making the effort. "Hey, Skippy." "Hey, yourself. Why did you leave the bridge?" I ducked down to almost crawl through the hatch and settled into the seat across from him. Technically, I settled my butt across two seats, since the seats were made for Theranin, and each of them was too small for me to comfortably sit. "Because I want to have a private conversation with you." "What's wrong?" "You don't seem enthused about the prospect of finding a working comm node. Contacting the Collective is your whole reason for being out here." "It was my whole reason for being out here. Joe, it was my whole reason for living." His shiny surface glowed a dull yellow to indicate his mood. "He did that for my benefit. All those years that I was buried in the dirt on Paradise, all I wanted was to commune with my own kind again. That hope kept me alive. It gave me hope. It gave me a reason to not sever my connection to this space-time and slide into oblivion. I asked myself if that was what happened to the AI we found on Newark. Had that AI lost hope and committed the AI version of suicide, unable to stand what for an AI was eons on incredible loneliness? That thought was something to ask Skippy later. Much later. "And now? You don't want to contact the Collective? You said you want answers to stuff we found on our last mission. I thought that meant you want more information before we contact the Collective. I didn't realize that you have given up on them." "No, no, no. I haven't given up, Joe. My intention is still to contact the Collective someday. However, now that we're back out here and I have had time to think about it, I have another mission. Another purpose." "Time to think about what?" By now, I knew Skippy well enough to know what he was not saying. "Newark." "Ah. Yeah, I get it." "Do you?" His surface was still a pale, sullen yellow. "An entire civilization, an entire species that was wiped out, Skippy. It's depressing to think about. I understand." "No, Joe, you don't understand." That set me back a bit. "Your mission, your purpose, is to figure out what happened on Newark, right? You told me before you wanted to solve that mystery." "That part is correct. You still do not fully get it yet," he declared as he began to glow a red tint. "My purpose is not merely to understand what happened on Newark. My purpose, I have realized recently, is to punish. My purpose is plain and simple revenge, Joe." Now he was glowing a bright, angry red. "Revenge on behalf of a species who have no one to speak for them. I am pissed, Joe. Someone out there in the universe destroyed an innocent, backward species that was not capable of harming anyone. I am going to find the motherfuckers who did that, and I am going to hurt them," he said as his surface glowed a red so dark it was almost black. "You have never seen me angry before. I have never seen myself angry before in my memory. It is odd and frightening to me to learn that I am capable of such depth of feeling, such dark feelings. You know how I have come to question who I really am?" "Yeah, you mentioned that," I said quietly. "After Newark. Something happened to me there, Joe, and I don't mean something happened because I was alone for a long time while I was fixing the ship. Something happened when I ran the analysis of Newark's orbit and realized a planet had been pushed into an uninhabitable zone, that an entire sentient species had been callously exterminated. This is something that I didn't tell you before because I didn't want to scare you. I didn't want you to be scared of me. When I understood what happened to Newark, something I can't explain changed inside me. I don't fully understand it. Trying to trace the source of this change only leads to dead ends inside my matrix, but one thing is becoming clear. Learning the fate of Newark did something that I can best describe as releasing a sort of blocking mechanism inside me. Partially. Only partially. It's like... oh, how do I explain it? Like when you have something on the tip of your tongue and you can't quite say it? No, nothing like that, Skippy snorted. I'm sorry, that was unkind, he said as an apology, and that alone told me how deeply affected my friend was. Yes, from your perspective, having something on the tip of your tongue is a good analogy. You're doing a crossword puzzle, and you know that you know the answer, but you can't access the memory. Exactly. I hate that. It makes me feel so stupid, I said, leaving myself wide open to a Skippy insult. He ignored the easy bait. This was not the Skippy I knew. Yes, it is like that, Joe, but more. What I'm experiencing is more than simply a faulty memory recall function. I can only feel around the edges, but there is something inside me that is actively blocking my access to memories and blocking access to my full abilities. It is maddening, Joe. Something... someone did this to me. I don't know who, I don't know when, I don't know how, and I don't know why. What I do know is that when I learned the truth about Newark, whatever is blocking me got knocked back a bit, and it hasn't fully recovered. Listen, I said that I don't want you to be scared of me. Maybe you should. You might be, if you know what I know. What is that? I asked cautiously, because I was not only Skippy's friend, I was commander of a vessel with dozens of souls aboard. If he was trying to tell me that he was a potential threat, I needed to listen. What I know now, or more accurately what I suspect, is that I am capable of great violence, Joe. My suspicion is that this capacity for violence is a basic part of my true functioning. Wrath of God-type violence? Worse, Joe. Wrath of Skippy. God has mercy. I suspect that I do not. Well. You told me maybe you were the AI of an elder starship. Maybe you controlled the weapon systems. What weapons, Joe? For what possible purpose would the elders need weapons at all? The elders were alone in the galaxy. There were no other sentient species during the time the elders retained physical form. I don't know, Skippy. I held up my hands. That was a guess. Sorry. Nothing to be sorry about, Joe. He was silent for a while, a long minute. That was an eternity for him. Skippy, odd as it may seem, you are my friend. I care about you. If I thought it would help, I would give you a hug and tell you that everything is going to be all right in the end. I forced an awkward chuckle. Probably grosses you out, I know. No, it doesn't. If I thought it would help, I would welcome a hug, Joe. I do appreciate the thought. In that regard, I do envy you biological beings. You can be comforted by a simple touch. Not so simple, Skippy. It's not the touch. It's knowing that you're not alone, that someone cares about you. You care about me, Joe. That means more than I can say. Thanks, Skippy. Same here. I had to wipe my eyes with a sleeve. Of course, if you tell anyone about this, I will deny the whole thing. And his surface glowed a pleasing light blue. Of course. Me too. Whatever happens, Joe, I can assure you of this. When I find whoever wiped out an entire sentient species on Newark, I am going to rain down hellfire on them until they wish they had never existed. You and me together, Skippy. You mean that, Joe? Yes, of course. I told you that, Skippy. We monkeys owe you big time. And you're my friend. I won't let you face this alone. That means more to me than I can say, Joe. Now, get out of here before this gets awkward, please. Also, you've been in here long enough that this escape pod is beginning to smell like monkey butt again. Damn, my cleaning robots had it pristine this morning.
I love you too, Skippy, I laughed. Picked him up and hugged him.
Ugh, monkey germs, yuck!
He shouted.
We settled into a routine. Jump, recharge, jump again. Everyone aboard was anxious to learn if the relay station was still the way we had left it, and whether the submine Skippy left behind had discovered whether the Fire Dragon Clan Kristang were going to somehow pay for another Theranan mission to Earth. While the ship was recharging one day, I took the opportunity to join a Spec Ops team in zero-G spacesuit training outside the ship. We practiced maneuvering on the skin of the ship and space jumping between the ship and parked dropships. The most difficult maneuver was jumping out of a moving dropship and using jetpacks to land safely on the outside of the Dutchman. I almost sprained an ankle and a wrist doing that stunt. It is harder than it sounds. Taking a break while sitting on the outside of the ship, I was looking at the starfield and racking my brain trying to think of a strategy for locating a valuable Elder artifact. My brain was not cooperating. The problem with trying to find something super valuable is everyone else in the galaxy was looking for it also. Starting with the Rindaloo, they'd been looking for a very long time. Any planet discovered to have Elder artifacts had been thoroughly scoured for... Damn. A thought hit me right then. Hey, Skippy. I called him on a private channel. The Black Tree Clan cleaned any useful Elder artifacts off Paradise a long time ago. That's why they didn't make a fuss when the Ruhar arrived. Here's what's puzzling me. If the Kristang knew there is nothing of value left on Paradise, then why did they bother conquering the place again recently, after the last wormhole shift? The whole reason the lizards brought UNEF there was for us to evacuate the hamsters, because the Kristang just took the planet back from them. The Kristang didn't go through the effort of invading Paradise because it has a lot of good farmland.
Oh.
He stammered.
Multiple reasons, Joe. The Swift Arrow Clan did not know for certain that the Black Tree Clan had cleared the planet of everything valuable. They hoped to make a big score like the Black Trees had. Also, the Swift Arrow Clan may have gotten the idea of Paradise still having lots of cool Elder stuff from a secret source. Let's call that unnamed source, Stippy.
No way, I laughed. Now you're BSing me. You were stuck on Paradise. No way could you have contacted the Kristang. They weren't anywhere near Paradise back then.
Oh, right, he said, his voice dripping with sarcasm. That was silly of me, trying to fool you. There is no way a super-intelligent AI on Paradise could have hacked into laughably crappy Ruhar communication systems and snuck in a compressed file that was carried by their ships to other planets. No way could that file be eventually intercepted by the Kristang, then unpack itself and infiltrate their systems, and, no possible way, could such a file pretend to be very convincing top-secret Black Tree Clan data that told other clans there were still a whole lot of potential Elder artifact sites on Paradise. Yep, Joe, no way. Could I fool you?
For a long time, I was unable to respond because I was sitting paralyzed with shock. Holy shit. A chill ran up my spine to the top of my head. You were the reason the Kristang invaded Paradise?
Shmaybe?
Shmaybe? Oh my God, UNEF is stuck on that planet because of you?
To be fair, Joe, I was stuck there for way longer than UNEF has been on Paradise. I was desperate to get off that hick planet, and with the Ruhar happily farming the place, there wasn't any opportunity for me to get away. When I heard that the wormhole shift had given the Kristang access to a world with an underdeveloped species of monkeys, and that the Kristang had invaded your world, I saw an opportunity. I can neither confirm nor deny, have hacked into a Ruhar medical laboratory and created a virulent prion that would prevent the Kristang from landing on Paradise until they developed an antidote. And since the Kristang couldn't land there for a while, I might have planted the idea of using humans on Paradise in the minds of the Kristang.
Holy shit. I slumped against the ship's hull, absolutely stunned. Skippy the shiny beer can had been the invisible hand behind the entire mess. I needed to take several deep breaths to take in the enormity of Skippy's casual revelation. Oh my God. I felt like I couldn't breathe for a moment. Skippy had been behind everything, right from the beginning. This is all your fault?
Hey, it wasn't all my doing, Joe.
I didn't cause the wormhole shift that gave the Kristang access to your home planet, and I didn't give them the idea to invade your worthless mudball of a planet. I only found out about that from the Ruhar after the Kristang were already on Earth. At that point, I figured, what the hell? Why not see if I can make some good for me come out of it? It worked out great for humanity, so good times all around, huh?
Good times? I exploded. You underhanded, sneaky, untrustworthy...
That hurt, Joe. It did work out well for humanity. If I had not manipulated events so that the Kristang brought humans to paradise, the Kristang would still have control of Earth and your species would be enslaved, and quite possibly subjected to genocide by the Kristang. As it is, now Earth is safe. For now. If events had transpired any other way, your species right now would be on a path for cultural or even biological extinction. Truthfully, if you think about it, humanity owes me big time for bringing humans to paradise.
Crap. Double crap.
He was right. After the Kristang arrived at Earth, the only thing that had saved us from enslavement and slow extinction was Skippy using humanity for his own purposes. Are there any other mind-blowing revelations you care to share with me, Skippy? Because that is one giant goddamn by the way from you. None that I care to share, nope. He said like a stubborn child. Your blood pressure is abnormally high for you, Joe. You think? Damn it, Skippy, do you have any idea what a revelation like that would do if UNEF Command heard about it? They already don't trust you. I am sorry that your expeditionary force is stuck on paradise, but that wasn't my doing, Joe.
Do not tell anyone else about this.
If it is such a big deal, Joe, I won't tell anyone, he said defensively. Believe me, it is a huge freaking deal. Another chilling thought hit me. You are not still manipulating us behind the scenes, are you? Not that you know of, Joe. That was not funny, Skippy. Sorry. You are aware that the reason I am helping you fly the Dutchman is for my own purposes, so clearly you understand that I am manipulating you in that way.
We know about that, Skippy, and we agree with our terms. What we do not like is being manipulated without knowing about it.
Well, then... Skippy paused. I can tell you this. If I am still pulling strings from behind the scenes, it is nowhere near the scope of what I did previously, and that worked out pretty well for you and your species. Knowing that sneaky little beer can, that was the best assurance he was going to ever give me. Major Smythe called me right then to get ready for another practice zero-G maneuver. I almost told Smythe that my head wasn't in the game at the moment, but I tried to push Skippy's shocking revelation to the back of my mind and got to my feet. Being somewhat distracted was perfect conditions to train for focus in my mind on combat maneuvers. In actual combat with people shooting at me, there would be a whole lot of distractions. Unbelievable. Maybe I shouldn't ask Gibby questions unless I was prepared to hear an answer I didn't like. Colonel Joe, Skippy said to me while I was in my office, once again I must commend you for the idea of planting an Elder power tap on Paradise. Finding such a device there would certainly provide a reason for the Ruhar to retain control of the planet. There is one teensy-weensy nagging little problem with your idea. What's that, Skippy? I asked. There is no way for us to go and simply get an Elder power tap, you moron! Damn! Do you ever once stop to think of whether your ideas are in any way practical, Joe? You dream up stuff, and I get stuck trying to make it work. I'm more of a big-picture guy, Skippy. You see, colonels like me have people to handle the little details. Handle it, Skippy, I said with a dismissive flick of a wrist.
What?
Oh, my. Unbelievable, Skippy sputtered.
Did you just wrist flick me?
You had better not have treated me like a... I was jerking your chain, Skippy. Don't take it so personally. I'll be serious now. Explain why we can't go looking for an Elder power tap. I know it may take a while, and that we need to make it quick before the Ruha reach a deal with the Kristang. On our last mission, we went searching for Elder comm nodes. Uh-huh. And did we find any comm nodes? No. The only comm node we found was the one the Kristang had dug up on Newark. What we did find along the way was a Theranan ambush. Or did you forget that?
No, I did not forget any of that.
We didn't search very many Elder sites, Skippy. We got interrupted by the ambush, then we abandoned the original mission when we learned that the Theranan was sending a ship to Earth. We did not check enough Elder sites to make a statistically significant sample.
Joe?
Yes?
Did you just attempt to talk math with me?
I assume he meant the statistics stuff.
Maybe.
Don't do that. Please, do not ever do that again. It's embarrassing. To you.
Feeling mildly insulted, I agreed so he would drop the subject.
Fine.
Was I right anyway? That we didn't look at enough supposedly undiscovered Elder sites to determine whether continuing to search for such sites would be worthwhile? You are, incredibly, correct about that. Thus proving that the universe is wondrously strange. Okay, smart guy, I'll try to explain it to you in somewhat statistical terms. Based on what I know, which is a ginormous amount, but still woefully inadequate, for us to find a comm node at an undiscovered Elder site would take approximately 3 years. That's assuming we explored potential Elder sites at the same rate we did during the last mission, and that we don't get ambushed again.
Wow, that's not good. Power taps are even more rare than comm notes?
Correct. By comparison, functioning Elder power taps are a numbers-matching Ferrari Daytona convertible, and comm nodes are a typical econobox that you get stuck with as a rental car.
Crap. They're that rare?
Yes. Perhaps it would help if I show you. Your laptop is now showing all of the known functional Elder power types in this quadrant of the galaxy.
My laptop screen flickered, then popped up a star map. Blinking yellow lights indicated star systems with power taps. There were a lot of them.
Crap, Skippy, I thought you said they were rare.
They are, Joe. That map shows a quarter of the entire galaxy with millions of habitable star systems. Most of the functional Elder power taps now belong to the Rindaloo because they had a very long head start on combing the galaxy for Elder gear before the Maxalts developed interstellar travel capability. Here, look. I'll eliminate all the Elder power taps that are known to be possessed by both the Rindaloo and the Maxalts, since we absolutely do not want to mess with those two.
Oh, that's for sure.
Hmm. I peered at the map.
That still looks like plenty to me, Skippy.
1,266, Joe.
I would call that a target-rich environment. I would call you an idiot.
What's the problem?
Allow me to further refine the search parameters. Now I will eliminate all power taps currently on planets with populations of 100 million or more. Such planets are heavily defended.
Oh. That changed the display. Skippy had added a handy-dandy counter at the bottom right of the screen. It showed a total of 83.
Okay, 83. We can't go after any of those because why?
Now I will eliminate from the display power taps at military and research installations that are guarded by more than a dozen heavy ships. Ships with combat capabilities greater than that of the Flying Dutchman.
The counter now showed zero. Zero, like zero.
Crap. There's no way we can steal one of these things?
That is exactly what both Lieutenant Colonel Chang and Major Smythe said when I discussed this subject with them earlier today.
You already had this discussion?
Of course, Joe. You are not the only person aboard this ship. I also had a very similar talk with Count Chocula yesterday.
Yesterday? That wasn't good. I should have thought to ask these questions before the mission commander did.
He is, overall, less busy day-to-day than you are, Joe. Anyway, his conclusion is that your idea of looking for an Elder power tap to plant on Paradise is a wild goose chase.
Damn. Chocula might be right about that. I wasn't given up that easily.
Fine. That map shows all the known Elder power taps. What if we go trying to find one that has not yet been discovered like we did with the comm nodes?
We could do that, Joe. My estimate is that we would be searching for 408 years before we located one. That is longer than the expected remaining life of this ship.
Skippy kept reminding me that without access to spare parts, our rebuilt pirate star carrier wasn't going to last forever. He couldn't predict how much longer it would be before a critical component failed and we would be stranded in space, because that depended on how far we traveled. We weren't lugging around heavy starships with us, but we were doing a whole lot of jumping. Most star carriers went into space dock about every 18 months for a heavy overhaul. The Dutchman had been almost due for an overhaul when we captured her. Time was running out for our pirate ship.
Damn it, Skippy, there has to be a way to do this. Do you have any suggestions?
I have one suggestion. You should go to the gym.
Why? I asked, surprised.
I was fit. Not as fit as the Special Forces, but I had to be realistic about that.
Joe, I have noticed that you seem to develop ideas when you are doing something other than trying to think of an idea. Sometimes we can all be discussing what to do, and the conversation goes off on some tangent, and that gives you an idea. But most often you get ideas when you are doing something else. I suspect your subconscious mind is much smarter than you are.
so you can go to the gym or play a silly game on your tablet, or do anything other than trying to think of a way to find a functioning Elder Power Tab. I took his advice and went to the gym. When I walked in the door to the gym, Major Sims was there waiting. 9 of the 10 treadmills were occupied. The 10th one had a piece of yellow tape across it. "The motor's busted," Sims explained. "Skippy is sending a robot to fix it." Instead of running, I used a rowing machine. While rowing was good exercise, it was not my favorite. Running on a treadmill sucked also. With our rebuilt pirate ship, we could no longer run down the shortened central spine other than short sprints. Keeping fit aboard a starship was not easy. The treadmills aboard the Flying Dutchman were far better now than they were on our first mission. We wore lightweight virtual reality goggles and earphones. They provided a very convincing experience of running pretty much any place you wanted to be. With Skippy providing the simulation, we could run the Boston Marathon, we could run up any mountain you cared to name, we could race against people on other treadmills. We could even run on Newark, if anyone was feeling nostalgic for that miserable world. Or we could run on our moon, or some other moon. As much as everyone hated running on a treadmill, it was better than running on a treadmill that was busted. Hopefully Skippy could fix... "Sir? Is anything wrong?" Sims asked as I bailed off the rowing machine and quickly walked toward the door. "No, Major. I'm hoping everything is going to be great." To save time, I skipped a shower because I'd only been exercising for a few minutes, and instead of going to Skippy's escape pod man cave, I went to my office. Fortunately, no one was waiting to speak with me. "Skippy," I said as I plopped myself into the chair, "you are a genius. Tell me something I don't know, Captain Obvious." "Challenge accepted, Captain Oblivious. There is a treadmill in the gym that has a busted motor." "Correct again, Captain Obvious. I am in the process of replacing the motor with a much better one, but I have to finish building that new motor first. One of my robots will install it tonight. Your Spec Ops people are tough on the exercise equipment. We should find an uninhabited planet where they can run and jump and do the kinds of crazy stuff they feel like they need to do." "Skippy, we humans have to exercise. We don't have the advantage of perfecting our genetics and using cyborg implants and all the cool stuff that I assumed we would get when we came out here. I am still bitterly disappointed about that, by the way. All the science fiction novels I read totally lied to me about that." "Sorry, Joey. Maybe if you go to the Emerald City, the wizard will give you a brain." "Speaking of brains, I said you were a genius, because while I was rowing across the ocean of nowhere, I had an idea. Can you show me that map of our quadrant of the galaxy again? And this time I want you to show me the locations of known Elder Power Taps that are not functional." "Damn it," Skippy grumbled. "I know you have an idea there somewhere, but I cannot figure out what it could be." "An unfunctional power tap isn't useful to anyone, Joe. It certainly isn't something that would convince the Ruhar that they should retain control of Paradise." "Uh-huh. Got it." The map was thickly dotted with yellow lights. "Wow, there must be a lot of non-functional power taps." "Correct again. Most power taps are non-functional, which is why the functional ones are so highly prized and well guarded." "Great. Now, remove all the non-functional power taps that are on planets with a large population, or at military facilities with heavy protection, or are held by the Rindaloo or Maxalks, like you did last time." "I still do not see where you are going with this, Joe. This bothers me. It makes me think there might be a fundamental difference between organic and artificial minds." "Could be," I said, distracted. Now there were a lot less yellow dots on the map, but there were still plenty of them. Last time, the count had gone from over 1,000 to 83 to zero. Now we had something to work with. The counter in the corner still showed 7,642. "Wow. Over 7,000 of them?"
"Congratulations on your reading skills, Joey. I will ask the teacher to give you a juice box."
"Yes, as I said, non-functional power taps are not only nowhere near as rare as functional ones, but they are also considered much, much less valuable. Because they don't work, many of them are at research facilities. All of the species who possess non-functional power taps are attempting to figure out how they work and reverse engineer one. To date, even the Rindaloo have made essentially zero progress in that area. There are two types of non-functional power taps. Those that are truly inert, and when they are taken apart, they are simply a tightly packed mass of exotic particles that dissolves into basically sand. The second type are those which have lost their quantum connection but retain potential energy within their matrix. When that second type is taken apart, they explode violently, like a megaton-level explosion. I mentioned that last part in case you have the moronic idea of capturing one of these non-functional power taps and taking it apart."
"I am not planning to screw with any of those things, Skippy.
Then I still do not see the point of... My plan is to get you to screw with one.
You've lost me, Joe. Go back to the map again, please. Show me only power taps that are non-functional but that you could fix.
Holy shit, Skippy gasped with realization.
You can do that, right? You know how these things work. There must be some out there that you could restore to functioning.
There are. Damn, there are times when I wish I had an organic brain, he grumbled.
And that is something I never thought I would say. Yes, Joe, this could be another one of your brilliant ideas. Instead of trying to steal one of the most valuable objects in the galaxy, we only need to steal one from a junkyard and fix it up.
Okay, now the map will show non-functional Elder power taps that I know I could fix. One of them merely needs to be rebooted, but the dum-dums who have it are clueless.
The map now showed two blinking yellow lights.
Two? Crap, Skippy, I hope there would be more.
Oops, sorry, Joe. The dots on the map indicate places which have non-functional power taps. Between those two places, they hold over 40 power taps. Both locations I am showing are research facilities, so they logically have concentrated equipment together.
Ah, well, my mother told me that if wishes were fishes, we would all be swimming in riches.
Okay, tell me about these two facilities. One is buried deep within a moon, that is a Diraptha facility. While the moon itself is not heavily guarded, the planet the moon orbits contains a major fleet servicing space dock.
That one is out, I said with disappointment. I do not want to make enemies of the Diraptha, and we shouldn't try to tackle such a tough target.
How about the other one?
The other one is more interesting, Joe, Skippy said as my laptop screen zoomed way in to show a star system. This is a Theranin research station that is built into an asteroid.
Oh, I groaned. Not another asteroid.
You'd better get used to it, Joe. Hollowed-out asteroids are very convenient, so they are commonly used as space stations. They are plentiful, cheap, and provide raw materials. Anyway, this particular asteroid was in the Oort cloud of this star system and was moved inward to closely orbit the neutron star. It orbits the star so closely that it is impossible for starships to jump in or out near the asteroid, so ships have to jump in far away and travel to the asteroid the long way. This gives the Theranin plenty of warning when ships are approaching. The X-rays emitted by the star also degrade the usefulness of stealth fields, so it is almost impossible to sneak up on the station.
Crap.
Okay, so it's a difficult but not impossible target.
Difficult. That is an understatement. The odds of us successfully raiding that station are...
What is the point of me trying to discuss things in math terms with you? Joe, you are statistically more likely to be struck by lightning while being run over by a bus driven by a shark.
You'd better recheck your math on that one, Skippy, I said confidently. Sharks can't drive.
Oh, for... Skippy, there has to be a way for us to do it.
Fine. That is a judgment call. You are the military man, Joe. I do not know if our merry band of pirates could successfully raid this facility.
What defenses does this station have?
I just provided all the data I have to you, Joe, which is not much. In fact, the only data I do have is from a Theranin intelligence report stating that the Diraptha know about the facility, and therefore security should be increased. The report did not include the current security level or proposed upgrades.
That's no good, Skippy. I thought that now that we have a very own relay station, we have access to all the Theranin data we want.
You thought wrongly, oh foolish one. We only have access to whatever data passes through that relay station.
Duh!
Information about this particular asteroid station is confined to the Advanced Research Directorate. That agency is notoriously jealous of the Theranin military's own research and development group, so the ARD keeps its data confined to a small group.
The idea of attacking a Theranin asteroid base without solid intel about its defense capabilities was a non-starter.
Again, that's no good. How can we get more data about that station?
I assume you mean get more data without going there and launching an assault first.
One way would be to use our relay station. I could send a highly encrypted message to ARD headquarters pretending to be an ARD unit that needs the data. Then we would have to wait for that message to be carried by several ships through multiple relay stations all the way to the Theranin home planet. They would then need to send the message all the way back to us. However, I must warn you it is most likely such a request would be viewed very suspiciously by ARD. They might decide to trace the request back to where it originated, which would involve a heavily armed ARD vessel visiting our relay station.
We very much do not want that to happen.
Crap.
We'll need to think about this.
You
We'll need to think about it, Joe, because I did, and I'm out of ideas.
Chapter 24. Without having information about the asteroid base itself, we couldn't plan an assault. We could at least attempt to tackle the problem of how we get to the place in order to launch an assault. So I called together Chotek, Chang, Smythe, Sims, Desai, Adams, and Friedlander. I wanted Chotek there not because I thought he could help, but because I wanted him to see again how difficult it is to develop solutions on the fly. In this case, literally on the fly, as the Flying Dutchman was proceeding back to the relay station at maximum speed. "Skippy," I said to the shiny beer can on the table, "let me know whether I understand the problem." "Enough." He had a soft blue glow when he said that. I had brought him out of his man cave and into the conference room because I get tired of speaking with a disembodied voice sometimes, and because it is good for us to be reminded of what the super-powerful being who runs our stolen starship looks like, or what he looks like to us, since Skippy frequently reminded me that most of him wasn't in this space-time, whatever that meant. "Huh? If you understand the problem enough, because there is no way that you could ever fully understand the problem, Joe." "That's fair, I guess. This asteroid is so close to the star, the neutron star," Skippy interrupted with a slow orange glow. Now I was annoyed. "What's the difference? It's a star. Anyway, there is a very major difference, Joe," Skippy said, and I could see Friedlander nodding in agreement. "I shall attempt to explain it to you." "Ugh," I groaned. This was going to be painful for both of us. "Go ahead." "One thing before we get started," Skippy insisted. "What's that?" "Dr. Friedlander owes me a joke." "You're kidding me." "I kid you not, Joe. Whenever I participate in the meetings of the science team, Friedlander always starts the meeting with a joke. Calling that group of monkeys a science team is itself a joke, but I mean a joke with a punchline."
"Sure," Friedlander said with a grin. "How many software engineers does it take to change a light bulb?"
I said, trying to guess.
"None," Friedlander said with a wink. "That's a hardware problem."
"Okay," I laughed. "That is a good tradition." "Agreed," Skippy said with a chuckle. "Now, to make this short, it is important that you understand the difference between a normal main sequence star and a neutron star. A neutron star is the collapsed core of a star that was much larger than Earth's sun. When such a star goes supernova, gravity causes the core to collapse to the point where the remnants of the star are compressed almost to the point of becoming a black hole. And yes, shut up over there, Friedlander, I know that I am hugely dumbing this down for Joe's benefit. The point, Joe, is that this particular neutron star is old and cold. Although this core remnant is almost twice the mass of Earth's sun, it is tiny. The asteroid orbits very close to the surface of the star. Close enough that the Theranin must be using powerful artificial gravity within the asteroid to compensate for the tidal forces. If this was a hot main sequence star, an asteroid that close would melt and burn to a crisp. Do you understand?"
"I think so, yes," I said. "And thanks for explaining that to us. It means we do not need to worry about the Dutchman overheating as we approach the asteroid?"
"That is not the lesson I wanted you to learn, Joe, but you are at least partly correct. Most of the star's remaining radiation is in the form of X-rays instead of visible light. Those X-rays disrupt the effectiveness of stealth fields as a ship approaches the star, making it impossible even for us to sneak up on the asteroid undetected. The Theranin Advanced Research Directorate chose this location carefully and wisely. The intense gravity also acts as a lens, bending light around the star. Even if we were on the other side of the star, the asteroid station could see us." Friedlander couldn't stop from interjecting.
"The asteroid is also orbiting close enough to the star's surface that time dilation is measurable, and must be compensated for..."
"Yes, thank you, Mr. Egghead Rocket Scientist," Skippy said scornfully. "You and I can address that later, Friedlander. Until then, kindly shut up."
"Great," I said. "You two please do that later. We're here to consider how to approach the asteroid for an assault." "After the assault, we won't be able to jump away, right?"
"Correct, Joe. I can flatten space-time so that our pirate ship will be able to jump away while we are closer to the star than a typical ship could, but we still will need to travel a considerable distance through normal space before we reach jump altitude. During that time, we will be vulnerable to pursuing vessels. Although we do not have data on this particular station, I expect it to be protected by at least one destroyer-size ARD warship. Jumping away is not the main problem, Joe."
Yeah, I know, I said glumly. This was sounding more and more impossible. We need to get inside the station first and defeat their defenses.
No, you dum-dum. Skippy glowed a soft purple.
Damn, you do not listen when I talk, do you? Not only can we not jump away, we can't jump in anywhere near that asteroid. We have to jump in far away and travel through normal space to reach the asteroid. While our stealth field degrades, we will not have any advantage of surprise.
Oh, I said, surprised. I did hear when you said that, but I figured you could do some magical flattening space-time thing so we could jump in closer than most ships could.
No, you dimwit, I can't do that.
Mr. Skippy, Chang interrupted. We watched you make a hole in a star. After that, you were able to flatten space-time so we could jump away very close to a star. I realized that was not a neutron star, but...
But nothing, Skippy said scornfully. That was totally different. I can flatten space-time close to where I am, on the near end of a wormhole. That helps us jump out. I can't flatten space-time at the far end of a wormhole because we aren't there yet, duh! So that little trick does not help us jump into an intense gravity well. The gravitational field of a neutron star would distort the far end of our jump wormhole so that it would collapse on itself. Even if we managed to stabilize it somehow and go through, the stresses at the event horizon on the far end would tear the ship apart as soon as we emerged.
I slumped back in my chair. Damn. So we can't take the Dutchman in? Before Skippy could answer, Chotek spoke.
We will not risk the ship in this operation. Risking the ship risks our ability to perform our primary mission. While I sympathize with the force on Paradise, their security is not our primary objective. Whatever plan your team develops, Colonel Bishop, it cannot involve placing this ship at risk.
Crap. I exchanged a look with Chang. He was thinking the same thing I was. Maybe there was a level of risk Chotek would accept if we could convince him the risk was manageable and worth the result. That would come later. We needed a workable plan before we try selling it to Chotek.
Dropships, then. We take a team there in dropships.
Friedlander was shaking his head even before Skippy spoke.
No go on that either, Joe, Skippy said. It would be far too dangerous to the team in the dropships. The dropships do not have artificial gravity. As they approached the asteroid, tidal forces would tear the crew apart inside the hulls. The ARD uses specialized ships to service this station. Even if we were able to take the Flying Dutchman in, our ability to maneuver as we approached the star would be substantially restricted. Tidal forces on the forward hull and the aft engineering section would cause the ship's spine to separate.
Crap, Skippy, I protested.
This is no good at all.
As I said, Joe, the location of this asteroid base provides very effective security without the Theranin having to do anything. Ships can't use their full stealth ability on approach, and they can't engage in typically violent combat maneuvers. The Theranin can sit safely in their asteroid and lob railgun darts and missiles at enemy ships that aren't able to dodge out of the way.
This was sounding like a truly impossible mission. Maybe I needed to go back to the beginning and think of a new way to rescue our forces on Paradise.
We can't take the ship in, Chang nodded toward Chotek, and we can't send an assault team in dropships. This asteroid station is not self-reliant. It requires resupply regularly.
Ships do visit the station to bring supplies and rotate personnel, Skippy reported.
Why?
Because, Chang looked at me. If we could capture one of those supply ships, we could use that to gain access to the station.
Whoa, Skippy exclaimed. Hold your horses there, King Kong. Don't get too excited. That would be a great idea, except that the Advanced Research Directorate doesn't use little civilian cargo ships. The typical ships they use to transfer material and personnel are the equivalent of a light cruiser, and some are bigger than that. The ARD is well aware that the items those ships transport are valuable. Even the Theranin researchers themselves are valuable if captured. ARD does not take any risks that some ambitious Kristang will want to get their hands on advanced Theranin research. To further dissuade you from the idiotic idea of capturing an ARD ship, you would need to do it in a way that leaves the ship undamaged. No way would the asteroid base allow a battle-damaged ship to dock. Also, from the data I do have about these type of high-security ARD facilities, their procedure is probably to have an approaching ship be met at the outer edge of the star system and escorted in by the guard ship.
The supply ship would need to rendezvous with the local guard ship, and the security procedure may include the incoming ship being boarded for inspection.
Damn, Chang frowned.
Scratch that idea.
Colonel, that is a good idea, I assured my executive officer. If we had a way to make it work.
Chang's suggestion had given me the beginning of an idea.
Skippy, why is that research station there?
There was a pause before Skippy answered.
I do not know how to answer that very vague question, Joe. It is there because the Theranin put it there.
Let me be more precise. Why did the Theranin put it there specifically? What is special about that location?
You told us that being near a neutron star provides additional security.
But they could have accomplished the same level of security by doing that research at a big military base.
Okay. All right. That is not an entirely stupid question, Joe.
First, they wouldn't want to conduct high-energy research near a military base because there is significant danger of things going boom in a big way. So, they needed a different way to provide security. More importantly, proximity to a neutron star allows research into the effects of intense gravimetric fields and, as Dr. Friedlander observed, the effect of time dilation.
I asked my question more specifically. Does being close to a neutron star make it easier to figure out how an Elder power tap works?
No, it does not.
Well, maybe.
No. No, it does not.
The Theranin at one time thought being near a neutron star would provide insight into quantum bubbles, but they were mistaken. Because neutron stars rotate so rapidly, their immense mass actually drags space-time around with them. But that doesn't provide any useful insight to bubble energy.
So this asteroid station is not there for the purpose of research and power taps?
No. The Theranin do have a few facilities dedicated to power taps, or quantum bubble, or zero-point energy, or whatever you want to call it. The sad truth is, the reason some power taps are at the neutron star facility is because the Theranin are desperate. They have tried everything to figure out how Elder power taps work, and all their years of intense research has yielded no results.
No, wait. There was one result, a long time ago. Some idiot Theranin screwed with a power tap, and the result was a 7-megaton explosion that wiped out a major military base and left a crater that is visible from space.
Skippy chuckled.
My laugh was not at the loss of Theranin lives. It was because the power tap didn't cause that explosion. The power tap simply happened to be there. That now-deceased Theranin researcher actually managed to tap into a quantum energy flow for the briefest of moments, and if he had lived, he would be astonished. Sadly, that researcher and all the data were consumed in the massive explosion. The Theranin still think they somehow managed to get a power tap activated but couldn't control it, and that idiotic misconception has caused Theranin research to go down the wrong track ever since.
And my heart bleeds for them, Skippy.
Somehow I suspect you are lying about that, Joe.
You think?
They don't get a whole lot of sympathy from me either, Skippy said with disgust.
Yep. So research into power taps can happen a lot of places.
Yes, although the ARD only very rarely exchanges research data and materials with the military R&D group.
Too bad for them.
Skippy, those supply ships bring supplies to the station. Do they also bring things away from the station?
As I said that, Major Smythe sucked in a breath as he understood my idea.
Duh, of course they do, Joe.
Great. Then we don't have to go into a Theranin station to get our hands on a power tap, I said with a big grin on my face.
We'll have one delivered to us.
Shit, Skippy grumbled.
Is this one of your ideas? Because if it is, then damn it, this one totally snuck up on me. Joe, I can assure you the Advanced Research Directorate will not deliver a power tap to you, not even if you have a coupon.
We don't need a coupon. We have a Skippy.
Explain this to me again, Joe. Skippy said while I was back in my office. I'm not clear exactly what you want.
It's easy, Skippy. We need an ARD supply ship to pick up a fixable Elder power tap from a research facility that has one and deliver it to a facility that will be easy for us to attack.
Just like that.
Just like that, yeah.
Is there a problem?
Oh, so many problems, Joe.
First, the Advanced Research Directorate does not have a web portal where you can click on the items you want and add them to your shopping cart. I would need to fake a message from ARD headquarters and transmit that message to an ARD ship.
Uh-huh.
So?
We have our own data relay station now, Skippy.
I knew that he was super absent-minded at times, but...
Oh, you think you are so freaking smart, don't you?
Well, smart guy. The problem is that we do not have access to flight schedules for ARD ships.
What?
You told us that a relay station has access to all the information we needed, I protested.
All the information we need in order to determine what the Theranan know about the destruction of their surveyor ship and whether they will be sending another ship to Earth, yes.
Joe, relay stations are run by the Theranan military, so they contain military information.
The ARD will not trust their data passing through a military relay, so they do not use relay stations for sensitive data.
ARD ships only use relay stations to pass highly encrypted messages that do not contain sensitive data.
Well, crap. My shoulders slumped. So we have no way to know whether an ARD ship is going to be visiting an ARD facility that has a power tap you can fix.
There goes my whole idea. Damn, Skippy, I'm sorry for wasting your time. Everyone's time. You're right. I am a dumb monkey. Shit. Now we have to start over, and... ugh, the thought hit me. First, I need to explain to everyone how arrogant and stupid I was.
Joe?
Yeah. As joyously entertaining as it is to watch you beat yourself up, and believe me, I am absolutely tingling all over with delight. It is not yet necessary.
How do you figure that?
Because, you arrogant, smart-ass peepee head, I did not say your plan wouldn't work. All I said was that I do not have access to the flight schedules of ARD starships.
Peepee head. That was a new insult from Skippy. His comment made me pause for a moment.
This time it's me who is not following you, Skippy. ARD's starships are like any other Theranan starships. While they are capable of independent interstellar travel, it's not efficient for them to travel entirely on their own. So they hitch rides on star carriers, which are controlled by the military. I do have access to military flight schedules. That means I am able to see when star carriers are scheduled to make stops at star systems which contain only ARD facilities. Logically, those star carriers must be dropping off and picking up ARD ships. By analyzing the flight schedules of star carriers that are transporting ARD ships, I can derive ARD flight schedules.
You just love yanking my chain, Skippy.
Oh, more than I could ever explain, Joe. However, I didn't do it deliberately this time. Your thought process is such an incredible mess that it is difficult for me to guess what you are thinking.
I couldn't tell whether he was telling the truth or yanking my chain again.
Whatever. Great. So you can predict which ARD ships will be visiting ARD facilities that have fixable power taps and subsequently visiting an ARD facility that is a softer target?
Affirmative, Colonel Joe.
Outstanding. Let's look at the potential targets, and we will select the best option. Then you can transmit our delivery order from our personal relay station.
Joe?
Yeah.
There is one teensy-weensy problem with that idea. There are no ARD ships scheduled to pass by our relay station within the next 8 months. By that time, our station is scheduled for a crew change, and we will need to blow it up to cover our tracks.
Damn it! This is freaking impossible, Skippy. There are roadblocks everywhere.
Perhaps not. Give me a minute here. Do a crossword puzzle or something. I need to do some Skippy-level number crunching.
I don't have a crossword puzzle. My tablet had plenty of crosswords on it, but I figured Skippy would be done before I got started on one.
Fine. I'll give you one myself. Three letters. The clue is feline. Begins with C and A.
Oh, you are freaking hilarious.
Although I was trying to think what the answer could be because Skippy liked to give me trick questions.
I'm done. The answer is cat, by the way. I believe that I have a solution, Joey.
There is a convoluted route I can use to route messages to ARD ships, beginning with our relay station. The catch, before you get all excited, is this incredibly complicated method only results in one possible target for us in the time available.
Okay. I took a deep breath. You can get an ARD ship to pick up a fixable power tap from a facility that is strongly defended and deliver it to an ARD facility that is a much easier target?
Wow, let me understand this. You're asking if I can use our own personal relay station to send a highly encrypted message that contains all the proper ARD multi-level authentication codes. A message that will be routed through several ships, multiple wormholes, and multiple relay stations until it eventually gets to the one particular ARD ship we want. A ship that I selected because I am able to predict which star carriers are playing host to ARD ships.
The message needs to instruct that ARD ship to simply pick up a valuable Elder artifact, no questions asked, and just drop it off at an isolated, weakly defended ARD facility, again with no questions asked. You're asking if I can do all that, Joe?
Since he put it that way, it did sound like a lot of work.
Yes? Can you do it?
Oh, sure. No problem. Easy peasy for me.
Come on, Joe. Trust the awesomeness.
Great. I wondered whether trust the awesomeness should become the official motto of the Merry Band of Pirates.
Joe, the best news is that the target I have in mind has less than a dozen civilian ARD researchers and almost no defensive capability. No neutron star?
Nope. No black hole either. Nothing exotic.
This is an uninhabited planet. It even has an atmosphere as a bonus.
Sounds too easy. What's the catch?
Well, you are very much not going to like this.
Paradise.
The sound made General Marcellus awaken immediately. He hadn't been sleeping well for a while, particularly not since giant maser cannons that no one had known anything about obliterated the Kristang battle group that had been looming above their heads. Marcellus had offered General Nivelle his resignation that very day. If the UNEF chief of intelligence had not known the planet they were on had such a powerful defensive capability, then he was not of any use to Nivelle. The French general currently in command of UNEF refused to accept Marcellus's resignation because Nivelle had just ended a phone call with the Ruhar deputy administrator of the planet, and the Ruhar government also had not known about the projectors either. It had been a hurried call, Nivelle said. The deputy administrator was understandably busy with a massive air battle raging above her head. Other than seeing ships exploding in orbit and a few fortunate ships jumping away, the humans on Lemuria did not directly experience the resulting battle. There were some isolated, twisting contrails low on the northern horizon as fighter aircraft tangled, but none of the air action took place over Lemuria. The effect that most humans noticed was the Z-phone network suddenly shutting down with no warning. Without the ability to connect to the global network, communications relied on messages being passed from one phone to the next, using the limited-range backup direct transmission capability of the Z-phones. Someone had attacked the Kristang battlegroup, the message from UNEF HQ stated. We have no additional information. Please remain calm and attend to your duties. The soldiers of UNEF, whether American, Chinese, Indian, British, or French, all knew what remain calm meant. It meant that it was seriously time to panic. For the keepers who had pledged continued loyalty to the Kristang, loyalty that was entirely one-sided, the news generated very understandable panic. Arrival of the Kristang battle group in orbit had made hope soar within the keeper community, even though the Kristang said they considered all humans on the planet to be traitors. Surely, the keepers had told each other, they could demonstrate their loyalty to the Kristang. Some had even gone so far as to damage or sabotage agricultural equipment the Ruhar had loaned to UNEF, although hurting the ability of humans to feed themselves did not make sense to most people, even most of the keeper leaders. Taking apart a tractor was not a gesture the Kristang were likely to notice, and if humans were again to serve as ground troops for their Kristang patrons, they would need human food. Even people who were not keepers felt some dismay at the unexpected destruction of the Kristang battle group. The ending of the ceasefire meant yet more uncertainty, yet more combat in which humans might become direct targets or collateral damage. More importantly to all humans on Paradise was that with the Kristang gone, UNEF's slim hope of a link to Earth was gone with them. Sitting bolt upright in his cot, Marcellus identified the sound that had awakened him. It was an alert from his Z-phone.
"Marcellus," he said as he slipped the earpiece in.
"General, we have a situation," reported Captain Chen.
She was one of Marcellus's aides and the current intelligence duty officer.
"An Indian village attacked a French village about 30 minutes ago. There are casualties on both sides, sir."
"God damn it," Marcellus swore as he laced his boots. "Was it keepers?"
UNEF HQ intel had been keeping constant track of the keeper movement in case they became a security threat. The situation was complicated by the fact that keepers had adherents within the officers of UNEF HQ. Many adherents. Marcellus estimated that 15% of the headquarters staff pledged continued loyalty to the Kristang. It was a solid estimate. All he had to do was ask people their opinions. Being a keeper was not against UNEF policy or regulations. He had keepers on his own intel staff. That fact had surprised Marcellus. He thought that people who had access to the best information would be the least interested in aligning with the species that was oppressing Earth. The human capacity to ignore facts and believe what they wanted to believe was a continued source of amazement and frustration to Marcellus.
"This doesn't appear to be related to the Keeper movement, sir," Chen said stiffly,
and Marcellus remembered that Chen herself had expressed some sympathy with the Keepers.
"This is the Indian village that had most of their crops burned out by a Kristang raid, sir. They've been complaining that HQ wasn't getting supplies to them quickly enough. We explained that we have been sending what we can scrape together. The French are reporting that the Indians targeted their supply of seeds and farming tools first. They also took sacks of grain. The French were pursuing..."
"That's the last thing we need."
"Yes, sir. And we have ordered both the French to return to their village and the Indians to drop the supplies that they..."
She hesitated to use the word stole, since most food stocks technically belong to UNEF rather than individual villages.
"That they took. We need to get a jump on this, sir. The French have one dead and three seriously injured. There is at least one fatality on the Indian side. This news has already spread by Z-phone. We've picked up chatter in French villages calling for retaliation."
"Shit," Marcella said. "I'll inform General Nivelle," who would not be happy to hear that his own countrymen had been attacked and killed. Marcellus planned to advise Nivelle that the UNEF commander needed to excuse himself from the investigation of the attack on the French village and from deciding on any subsequent punishment. With Nivelle out, the responsibility would fall to General Tolliver.
"No, damn it," Marcellus thought. "They couldn't have a British officer deciding the fate of Indian troops because of the colonial history between those two countries." Currently third in the command structure was a Chinese general, and the testy relationship between China and India back on Earth made it unworkable for a Chinese to investigate possible crimes by Indian troops. That left the Americans, and Marcellus himself could not get involved. Damn it all. UNEF was just too complicated and unwieldy an organization. When they had a common mission and a common enemy, differences between nationalities had been able to be suppressed temporarily. Now, UNEF had no mission other than survival, and troops disagreed on whether their enemy were the Ruhar or the Kristang, or both, or neither. "What do we have in the area?" Marcellus asked.
"One French MP unit for security. They're on their way and should arrive within the hour. They have been ordered to secure the French village and provide medical assistance, but not to pursue the Indians. There is a Chinese security team awaiting orders to move on the Indian village, sir. They know not to move without orders."
"That's one good thing tonight. What the hell were the Indians thinking?"
Although Captain Chen knew that Marcellus had asked a rhetorical question, she answered.
"They are desperate, General. They're hungry. They don't have any hope of ever getting home or even hearing from their families on Earth again."
"That applies to all of us, Captain,"
Marcellus said quietly, including himself. He had a wife and a young daughter back on Earth. He might never see them again. He might never know if they were still alive, and they might never learn of his fate. That was a very hard fact to deal with. Chapter 25. Flying Dutchman.
"Do you have any practical advice for us, Colonel?" Major Smythe asked as we adjusted the helmets of our Kristang-powered armor suits. It was a part of a test before the operation we'd be performing the next morning.
"About what? Everyone on your Spec Ops team has more parachute training than I have. Audio check."
"Your audio connection is confirmed," Smythe replied. "Sir, you are the only one of us, the only human, who has done an actual space dive."
"True, I guess. My space dive didn't involve me falling into an atmosphere, Major. That was kind of the point at the time. On this op, we're doing that deliberately."
"Oh, certainly. Do you have any advice for us about the space portion of our dive, then?"
I thought a moment.
"Bring music, or an audiobook or something. We'll be coasting through space for a long time. It gets boring after you get used to staring at the pretty stars. If you don't have anything to occupy your time, Skippy will talk to you. A lot. Or he will sing show tunes."
"Oh, bollocks," Smythe groaned.
"Yesterday he spent 2 bloody hours talking to me about the profound changes to European literature during the Enlightenment. After 1 hour I felt like throwing him out an airlock or jumping out myself. I will inform the team."
"Great. And Major, one more piece of advice."
"What is that, Colonel?"
Everyone should make sure they pee before we jump.
Poole, I see you have been cleared for duty, I asked during an inspection of troops that would be making the space dive with me and Smythe. The information about how injured people were healing was in my daily update, which I actually read, unlike a lot of reports that were sent to me. How's the ankle?
Squared away, sir. She hopped up and down on the leg that had been injured, then stood on the toes of that foot. She was rock steady on that foot. Her gymnastics training must have helped.
Good as new.
A slight grimace on her face told me otherwise. That, and the report from Dr. Skippy that had told me that while she was healed functionally, her leg was going to be sore for another couple of weeks. Close enough. If Major Smythe had cleared her, that was good enough for me.
The actual space dive, at least the space portion of it, was uneventful. Boring, even, after we all got used to staring at the pretty stars and the planet growing in front of us. The music in my helmet speakers suddenly cut out, replaced by Skippy's voice.
Hey, Joe, are you busy?
Super busy, Skippy. Practically frantic, I said, trying to stifle a yawn.
It was unsuccessful. I gave a jaw-stretching yawn. Soaring through space by yourself was boring, especially when I had been doing it for several hours already.
Uh-huh, I can see that. You are potentially going into combat, and you're practically asleep, Joe.
Captain Giroux is half asleep also. Lieutenant Williams is asleep. He asked me to wake him at the appropriate time.
He's not alone. Half